to use for people to come out here and use firearms against the people that are protesting. This is the messages that we're seeing. I don't know if you are on social media because the news don't tell you everything. But you have to pay attention to what's going on.
Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's go! Let's
go! I will use my voice in the most uplifting way possible. And do everything in my power to educate my community.
Last night, protests in the name of George Floyd, a black man who was killed by a white police officer, continued around the country and around the world. In an attempt to quell the tension, some cities implemented curfews, which many protesters ignored. Other law enforcement officials attempted to show support for protesters by taking a knee or marching alongside them. But there were still numerous clashes between police and protesters, a clear example of just how strained the relationship between police and black people in this country has remained. In New York City, police officers were overheard on Tuesday on the citywide police scanner threatening physical violence against protesters.
We have a group of people blocking traffic on Albany and D Street. They're refusing to let the orange go eastbound on D Street and Albany. So we're stuck here.
Run them over.
Shut the f***. Don't put that over yet.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, we're exploring policing in the United States. And we start with a look at how deep the cultural biases are in police departments across the U.S. and what can be done to root them out. We're joined now by Phil Stinson, professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio and a former police officer. Phil tracks police misconduct allegations, and he's also the author of the book Criminology Explains Police Violence, and weighed in for us on the police response to the recent uprising.
Well, keep in mind, we have more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. And it's not just the large cities that are having to deal with protesters and demonstrations over the last week or so. It's small towns, it's large cities, it's suburban areas, it's pretty much everywhere. And I don't think that many law enforcement agencies understand the deep-rooted problems that are giving rise to so many people of so many different walks of life wanting to get involved and wanting their voices to be heard and wanting to get out in public and share the moment with their friends and their neighbors. The problem is, when we all watched that video last week, the 8 to 10 minute video where Mr. Floyd was killed in front of our eyes, it was troubling on many levels. And one of the concerns is that people of all walks of life look at that video, and that if they haven't experienced being roughed up by the police, being beaten up by a police officer, being treated with a heavy hand by a police officer, they may well know somebody who has been treated that way. And it's touched so many lives that people have just had enough. They think, we see this over and over again. And the fact of the matter is, these types of incidents where police officers manhandle somebody, where they rough somebody up, where they use too much force gratuitously, happen every day across this country.
So I want to break down a little bit more of that, because I feel like, you know, again, a lot of the images that I'm seeing are reminiscent of when I was covering the events in Ferguson after the death of Michael Brown, and the moment that really Black Lives Matter catalyzed and became, you know, really the head of what we were seeing in terms of protests around the country. What we're seeing now, I think, that's different, and I'm curious to know your thoughts, is that there are some police departments that have shown some solidarity, as we mentioned, marching with protesters. That feels new. Is it a PR stunt? Is it authentic? Is this PDs who've realized, you know, we really need to get our act together, and so we're going to march in solidarity? How do you assess those?
I think it's sincere, and I think it's from the heart. I think what's different in this incident is that in the past, when we've watched videos, when we've looked at photographs, when I talk to law enforcement officers across the country, often in past incidents, they will have an explanation. They'll say, well, you're not understanding the big picture. There's another side to the story. You don't know what we deal with on a daily basis. I'm not hearing that this week. What I'm hearing from law enforcement officers, from friends and former colleagues and people who've contacted me, is that everybody is absolutely dismayed and without words to explain it. It's not explainable. You can't rationally explain what happened other than it was a willful and deliberate act. It went too far. And it was troubling to other law enforcement officers because at some point, a few minutes into that video, one of the other officers who was on the scene there should have tackled the officer that had his knee in Mr. Floyd's neck and removed him. It was out of control. And the fact that the other officers just stood by, tell me that's normal behavior, not to kill somebody, but to rough somebody up, to take it too far, to teach somebody a lesson. It was, frankly, a gleeful exercise of street justice. That's what we saw there. It was teaching Mr. Floyd a lesson so he wouldn't give them a hard time if they ran into each other in the future.
I mean, we've seen this happen before with the death of Eric Garner, again, on video, saying the same words that Mr. Floyd said, which is, I can't breathe. And in that instance, again, another loss, another death of an unarmed black man for living his life. And so I wonder what it is that changed now.
Well, what's different about that incident, what law enforcement officers have told me, is that with Eric Garner, they were still trying to secure him. They were still trying to get him handcuffed, that they were trying to effect an arrest. Here, the situation is completely different. At one point, it seems like they had Mr. Floyd handcuffed in a police cruiser, and then he ends up handcuffed on the ground. He was no threat at all to the officers there in that video that we watched. And I think that's the difference, is that law enforcement officers looking at this video, they see a difference and they can't explain it. And they're starting to realize maybe there is a problem, even when they don't want to admit it. Maybe there's not a problem in their department, they say, but we get it. We're starting to get it. And I think that's what's happening. That's what's different in this video. And people all across the country can tell you these aren't isolated events, but this one, law enforcement officers can't explain it away. They just can't. And that's the difference.
I mean, I would argue that they couldn't explain away Eric Garner either, but that would be, you know, for another segment of another show. You know, law enforcement in this country does have a history in some elements. They're often talked about as bad apples, right? Cops like the one who killed George Floyd, for example. But there are deeper systemic issues in law enforcement and police departments across the country that are tied to racism. What element here is about police training?
Well, as to the bad apple theory, we've gone way beyond that. You know, in the New York Police Department, the Mullen Commission back in 1994 thought that they had gotten rid of the bad apple theory and proved it wrong. I mean, this is not a few bad apples. This is the police subculture. This is normal police behaviors in terms of using too much force on a regular basis. It's not a situation of a few bad apples. You can't explain it that way. It's way beyond that. So it is an issue of training, it's an issue of supervision, and it's an issue of the socialization process within police departments into the police culture, or the police subculture, as I call it, on a local level. It's very complicated and nuanced because there are many levels here that have to be dealt with. There's no easy fix to the situation, but it's systemic. There's institutional racism in the criminal justice system, and there's certainly institutional racism in policing across the country. And I can tell you, it's complicated by the fact that the Supreme Court gives deference to police officers in street encounters. They've allowed racial profiling to occur without any accountability across the country. So there's so many different levels here. It's not an easy fix.
Let's talk a little bit about the systemic racism part of this. We know, for example, with Eric Garner, the move in question there was the chokehold that was used on Mr. Garner. Here at the Minneapolis Police Department, there was a neck restraint used by the officer who ultimately killed George Floyd. We know that data from the Minneapolis Police Department shows that 2/3 of the people who were put in neck restraints by police there are black. Explain to us that tactic, and is it going to come under investigation as the chokehold did here in New York after the death of Mr. Garner?
Well, the data from the Minneapolis Police Department, I've reviewed it, and it's frankly shocking. There's 4 types of neck restraints that they document in their data, and the numbers are just very troubling in terms of, you know, African Americans who were subjected to these compliance procedures, if you will. And one of the most troubling ones was they actually have a procedure that allows an officer to render someone unconscious with a chokehold. And to me, that is just shocking. You know, I was a police officer for a few years, a very long time ago, and I can tell you when I was a recruit at the New Hampshire Police Academy in 1986, that certainly wasn't allowed. It was well understood then in my training that certain types of neck holds would be the application of deadly force. In other words, you don't do it unless you're intending to kill somebody to stop a threat in hand-to-hand combat. It's not acceptable. It's shocking. It shouldn't be allowed. And I think the problem here is that, you know, one of the deep, dark secrets of the police subculture is that there's a general fear of black men and boys. And that's what's at the root of all this. It's just that police officers, for whatever reason, handle their encounters with black males, African-American males, different than they do with anybody else.
Phil, I want to stop you there because I want to make sure we're being clear. We're talking about how police engage and handle their encounters with black men and boys. Are we talking about all police, white police, multiracial police? Who are we talking about?
I'm talking about as a generalization. I don't want to say all police officers, but frankly, that really is what I'm trying to get at. I'm not saying some police officers, and I'm not saying it's implicit bias. It's way beyond that. We can't cure this and fix our way out of it with a few hours of implicit bias training. It's a deep-rooted fear that police officers are socialized into. And it, frankly, we see this with officers of color as well. It's part of their makeup as a police officer. It's part of the type of policing they do. Think about the fact that we're always dealing with wars, right? We got a war on crime. We got a war on drugs. Everything's handled as a war. And we send the police officers into their jobs every day as warriors. They don't live and work in the same communities. They typically live elsewhere. Their children go to different schools than the children in the neighborhoods in which they work as police officers. Their family worship at different places. They shop at different schools. They go to job as if they're going to war every day. And they really treat African-American males, men and boys, as a threat. They're fearful of black men and boys.
Let's be clear that the police that we're seeing on the ground right now, again, not every single officer, but generally speaking, a lot of police departments around the country have heavy military gear. The police in this country have become more militarized. I mean, covering Ferguson, you saw tanks on the ground. There have been calls for the National Guard to come in. Has that affected the increasing militarization of police departments? Has that added to the increase in violence that we're also seeing with some police officers?
Well, you know, the militarization of police goes way back. It goes back well into the early middle part of the 20th century. It's not something that's new. And I want to be careful not to criticize some of the equipment law enforcement has at different agencies across the country, a lot of it with federal funding that's supplied, because there is a time and a place for some of that equipment to be used. The problem is, when do we take that equipment out? When do law enforcement officers use that type of equipment? And frankly, I think it's inappropriate this week to roll some of those tank-like vehicles out. It's just completely inappropriate. That's not the way I'd handle it. And we have seen, as you pointed out, some really positive interactions that police chiefs and county sheriffs and their officers and deputies have exhibited dealing with citizens this week at rallies and at protests. And we've seen them doing the right things. We see Erica Shields, the police chief in Atlanta, getting out and listening to people. That's really important. And it's something that law enforcement officers are not very good at. They like to tell people what to do. They like to bark out commands and orders, but they're not very good at listening. And I think we can learn a lot there.
Phil Stinson is a professor and criminologist at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Phil, thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.